From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is January 6th, 2020, Monday morning, and we're happy to welcome you to the first Monday Morning Dave Graham Show of the new decade. And we have a good show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be talking first with Congressman Peter Welch. Our second guest this morning in the second half hour will be Colin Ryan, the managing editor of VT Digger. He's going to update us on some recent Vermont stories. And later on, we're going to have Peter Galbraith on the line. He's going to give us a little bit of his thinking about what's going on with Iran since this the United States bombing that took out General Soleimani in Baghdad, and of course has set off a lot of international consternation and upset and so on. But first, let's go to Congressman Peter Welch, who's on the line with me this morning. Congressman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And tell us first off your thoughts about the decision of President Trump the other evening to, or I guess it was the other early Friday morning, maybe in Iran, this happened. But the news broke in the evening on Thursday, I believe it was, about this the killing of General Soleimani. What are your thoughts about this?
It was an incredibly bad decision because it is going to compromise, and it already has, our national security interests. That's the issue. You know, Soleimani is not a question of whether the killing was justified. He has been an architect of these roadside bombs. He's a bad guy. The question is whether it was wise. And what has happened since this killing is that the goal Soleimani and Iran had of getting the United States out of Iraq is picking up steam. The Iraqi parliament just voted that all American soldiers be expelled from Iraq. That's number one. Number two, in Iraq, there were enormous street demonstrations, and they were against Iran. The fact is that many of the Iranians, particularly the Kurdish and the Sunni, are absolutely outraged at Iranian interference and involvement in affairs there. All those demonstrators are now focusing their wrath on the United States. So this action the president took to show what a tough guy he is has actually set back the progress that we were in the process of making. Then the third thing on this, the president tore up the Iran nuclear deal. And despite that, Iran stayed in it for 5 years. And the president said one of his reasons for getting out was 15 years of absolute guarantee of no nuclear Iran was too little. And now he's shortened 15 to 5. So on every level where you're looking at what is our national security interest, the president's action, the effect of his action has been to make things worse, not better. He turned the Iraqis against us. He's created sympathy for the Iranians. And the nuclear deal, that even though we got out of it, Iran was abiding by, Iran is now saying they're no longer going to be part of it. So I would call this an extraordinarily bad, unwise decision.
Well, that is a quite a resounding condemnation, I would say. And I wonder, let's break these down each one by one, because you talked about the vote in the Iraqi parliament to say that the United States should leave Iraq. That was not the sentiment before, correct? And I gather that, I mean, in the worst case scenario here, it looks like the United States could end up as being really nothing more than an occupying force in Iraq for as long as it remains there.
Well, that's right. I mean, just think about this. First of all, President Trump, when he was campaigning and in his early days as president, said he wanted to get out of these endless wars. I support him in that. Mm-hmm. This is dead end for us. And his goal was to bring troops home. What did he do yesterday? He sent 3,500 more troops to Iraq as the parliament was voting to kick out the troops that are there. So the consequence of the president's own action is to defeat his own stated goals to bring troops home. He's putting them back in, and he now has the opposition of the Iraqi government, including the prime minister, who's made it very clear he's going to sign this bill. Secondly, he's increased the danger. I mean, this whole, his whole boast that this was going to make us safer and that absurd interview that Secretary Pompeo had where he said this is making us safer. If it's making us safer, why are we telling all Americans who are in Iraq to come home? Why are we doing lockdown on our activities around our bases? Why are we suspending the work that we were doing that justified our presence, and that was training Iraqi forces to be prepared to fight ISIS if they reemerge? So it's truly a reckless decision where the president shot America in the foot.
And if Iraq were to retaliate in the way that some of the saber rattlers over there are talking about, that would be pretty reckless too. And it strikes me that there is some possibility anyway that they may think better of it and say, okay, this is a really bad thing the United States did, but we are not going to, get into a tit for tat with this huge and powerful military force.
Well, I certainly hope that is the case, but think about it. Really, what is the number one objective of the Iranian mullahs? It's to stay in power. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's more than to fight Saudi Arabia. It's more than to sow discord in Iraq. The main existential goal for that theocracy is for the mullahs to stay in power. And they have now been humiliated as a result of the assassination of what is perceived to be the second most powerful person in Iraq. Mm-hmm. So they feel under immense domestic pressure to show they're not going to take it. So let's hope they don't. You know, that's a scenario that we can wish for, that they won't retaliate. But it's very, very unlikely that there'll be no retaliation. And they're saying it. I mean, everything they're saying indicates that they want vengeance.
Yeah, and certainly you would expect that rhetoric. I mean, I just do you think though that, I mean, just to sort of think this through or play it out a little bit, if Iraq ends up not doing much of anything,
Iran.
If Iran ends up not doing anything in terms of retaliation against the United States, will this look like a win for Trump?
You know, it's not a win. I mean, let me go back to something that's even more basic than this attack.
Mm-hmm.
What is the point of the attack? What is the threat that Iran poses to us? Is it the highest order threat to our national security? Isn't Russia, with their interference in our election, with their breaking international norms by taking over Crimea, with their hot war in eastern Ukraine, isn't China, which has been very aggressive in asserting its power and compromising a lot of our economic strengths, isn't Al-Qaeda, which is not totally gone, aren't these much more higher order threats to national security? So the president, by his action, is elevating Iran from what is, they're engaged in bad stuff there, but it's not stuff that threatens our homeland as directly as some of the things that are much higher order threats. So what is the president think he's doing other than asserting himself? And by all indications, this decision was made in the usual way that President Trump makes decisions, impulsively. It wasn't being recommended by anyone as being consequential. There was no process to start considering what are the consequences of this action. I mean, he has about as much thought going into a major decision that has implications for the safety of our troops and our country, less attention than a Vermonter who's deciding to buy a new car.
That's a rather stark picture you paint there, and I mean, I think that a lot of the facts on the ground support that contention that he's not really thinking this through. I mean, and you mentioned all these bigger problems for the United States, and I mean, is there some sense that when the schoolyard bully feels like he can't really take on the guys who might actually beat him, he's going to beat somebody perceived to be weaker?
Well, that could be. I mean, the fact is the president does not have impulse control. I mean, this we've got a situation since 9/11 where there's vast power in the commander-in-chief to act. And frankly, I think there's been way too much delegation of authority by Congress on this question of acts of war to the president. It's a real, real problem in my view, and it's why I'm fighting to have a much more assertive Congress and reclaiming war powers authority. But the reality is right now, the president can do everything and does everything from getting us in a war to taking actions like taking out Soleimani that are going to get us into a war. It's a very dangerous situation. Now, presidents in the past have had more restraint. President Trump has none. And, you know, some of the reports were that the thing that really motivated both the president and, of course, Pompeo were the attacks around our embassy. And that's a legitimate concern, obviously. But the action that the president took, it was in part because he's watching on TV what's going on at the embassy, and he got upset. Well, being upset is not part of what president bases a decision on. The decision has to be cool, calm, and ruthlessly focused on will this enhance our security or not. In Pompeo, I remember him when he was an incredible bully on the whole Benghazi hearing. He was part of the panel, and he did that. We lost that wonderful ambassador we had there and several others. Mm-hmm. And that became, for Pompeo and others, just a way to try to really hammer at Secretary of State. And he was paranoid about having his own Benghazi. So they both cast aside, both Pompeo but the president obviously is the decider here, their sense of judgment and caution that when you take an action, there's going to be a reaction. So this is, one, dangerous, but two, it's really emblematic of the way in which our president, with the awesome powers of being commander-in-chief, makes decisions in a very haphazard, feckless way. It's extremely worrisome.
Let me go to a caller here. We have actually a couple on the line. Do you mind? We can hear from a couple of Vermonters here. Jeff from West Braintree is on the line. Good morning, Jeff.
Yeah, as usual, Welch won't tell you the truth. And Trump has shown a lot of restraint. Matter of fact, this summer, there was an oil tanker hit over there and people injured, and he was all ready to make a strike. And his people told, he asked his people, will there be collateral damage, people killed? They said, yes, there will be, and he called it off. So there's one example that Welch isn't telling you. Another thing, I just got done listening to General Jack Keane, and he said, this is way overdue, this killing of Soleimani, whatever his name is. He said, for 20 years, this guy's been running around from Tehran to Baghdad to Russia, back and forth, unimpeded. And he's got the blood of many, many Americans on his hands,
okay.
And it was way overdue.
Congressman, what do you think?
Well, two things. First of all, you're right. And it's part of my being upset about this. Trump did show restraint. Our drone was shot down, he didn't act. After those ships were attacked, he didn't. We've got some feedback on the call here.
Yeah, a little bit.
So the caller is right that the president did have restraint. It's part of what is so upsetting to me, where when he decided not to have restraint, he went over the top. And then second, I've heard General Keane, a respected military person. Soleimani is a bad guy. Chou En-lai was a bad guy. Mao Zedong was a bad guy. But a country does not go around taking out other foreign leaders just because they're a bad guy. Our decisions have to be based on, will this action advance or diminish our national security? It's not just because it's a bad guy that we take them out. And what the consequences are right now, immediately from this action, is that the Iraqi parliament has voted that the United States be out of Iraq. That is what Soleimani and Iran were attempting to achieve. So in his death as a, quote, martyr, Soleimani is going to accomplish, in effect, what Iran and he had been seeking to achieve, and that is get our soldiers out of Iraq.
Well, let's go to another caller here. We have Sam from Williston. Good morning, Sam. Sam, are you with us?
We're running out of urgence now. So maybe the rest of them won't stand up so tall. He's a cowboy if he does. He's a wimp if he doesn't. This guy doesn't have a chance of winning on any decision he makes. This would have been a Benghazi if we let them run over the embassy there. And so we were just going to let them run over another embassy. That's their go-to place. They took our embassy over from us in the 70s. They ran over Benghazi. That was their boys that were running the show. And here we go. You blame that one on a movie maker, the Benghazi situation. So, you know, it's a lot of things here that we as Americans have to understand. Friday afternoons, they take everybody down to Ted Chopper Square in those parts of the world. So yeah. They understand the thumb.
All right. Hey, I gotta run, but thanks for the call, Sam. Let's go to Fred Newbury. What's on your mind, Fred?
Hey, can you tell me this? Do you think the United States will ever have to pull Russian chestnuts out of Chinese fires?
I don't know, Fred.
How about the guest? Does he know?
Well, I don't. Well, okay. You want to take a stab at that, Congressman? I'm not exactly sure I understand. But
they're more adversaries. They're not real allies. In the old days, they were allies. The Sino-Soviet alliance. That was, you know, China and Russia working together. And actually, it was President Nixon who drove the wedge between them with his trip to China. So I don't see Russia coming to the defense of China.
All right. Thanks for the call, Fred. Hey, Congressman, we just have a few minutes to go here, and I did want to cover a couple of other topics here. I mean, obviously, this one is huge, and I certainly hope for the best here. Well, actually, let's get one more. We've got a couple more calls here. This is really lighting up the board here. So okay. Let's get a couple other listeners in here. Bill from Moortown. Good morning, Bill. Bill, you with us? Bill seems not to be there anymore. How about Don from Elmore?
And Congressman Welch.
Good morning.
I think strategically this was a very foolish move, any way you slice it. But Congressman, I wish you would get your figures straight on the Iraqi parliament, because everything I've seen and heard indicates there were far less than 50% of the parliament there to vote. They barely made a quorum, and it certainly wasn't an overwhelming vote to have all the Americans out.
Well, you know, you're right, because the people that didn't show up were the Shia, but the Sunni and the Kurdish Iraqis, members of parliament, were there. And as you know, there's a huge divide within Iraq between essentially the Shia, who have a lot of Iranian sympathies, and the Kurds and the
I understand that, sir, but that's not the way you presented it. You presented it as a majority vote of the entire parliament, which it was not.
Well, let's get clear. It was a unanimous vote of all the members of parliament who were there. I mean, if we have a vote in the Vermont legislature and there's a quorum and it's a unanimous vote, then that has the force of law. So I'm in agreement with you that some of those members didn't show up, but the effect of that vote is that the official position of Iraq is for the U.S. troops to get out. And the prime minister has indicated, actually he supported this and indicated he's going to sign it. Now, all of that happened as a result of the decision that President Trump made to attack General Soleimani. By the way, on Iraq soil, this is a real issue for the Iraqis. And think about it, because this just makes common sense. They're worried, all of them in Iraq, that the U.S. and Iran are going to have a war in Iraq. They're going to fight that out in Iraq. So the Iraqis are just pawns in this situation. So the president, this action is just so counterproductive to even what he says he wants to achieve.
All right. Thank you for the call, Don. I do want to, one more on this one. Let's go to Bill in Moortown if Bill's still there.
Yes, I'm still here.
All right.
Mr. Congressman, if we don't start stopping them right now and take out their leaders, I realize that we have a problem in Iraq and we'll probably fight on that in Iraqi soil. However, if they can't get to Iraq from Iran, how are they going to fight? Thank you.
Well, first of all, the issue we've had, you know, in Iraq, it goes back to what I think was an extraordinarily bad decision by President Bush to invade Iraq after 9/11. The Iraqis were not involved in 9/11. It was much more Saudi Arabia. So much of the heartache that it is occurring is a result of that disastrous decision by President Bush to invade Iraq after 9/11. Fast forward, you have a military victory, but then you have the Sunni uprising, and then following that, you have ISIS. And ironically, when it came to the fight against ISIS, both in Syria and in Iraq, the Iranians, led by General Soleimani, we made a deal with them and cooperated when it came to fighting a common enemy. The Iranians hate ISIS. We hate ISIS. And we actually fought together to accomplish that. So I'm just giving that background to indicate that it gets complicated on some of these decisions you have to make. But the goal for us always has to be the safety and security of the people of this country. And President Trump in the past has talked about it's a bunch of sand over there, and he doesn't want us to be in endless wars. I agree with that statement. I agree with President Trump's stated goal. But what he's done now has resulted in him sending from Fort Bragg 3,500 more troops to Iraq instead of bringing home 3,500 troops. So the concerns you have, I agree with, but this particular decision is already playing out in ways that are undercutting the president's own stated goals for no benefit and real detriment to our national security.
Let me go to another a slight tangent here, which is that, is this a wag the dog operation? I mean, was one of the intents of the president here, do you think, merely to take attention away from certain other issues, including one that starts with the letter I?
You know, I don't want to go there, because I just never want to think that a president, any president, including this president, would ever do anything that would put our soldiers in harm's way for political benefit. I think this was just a really, really bad decision that the president made. He didn't think it out what the consequences would be. We know he didn't think it out. I mean, he was down at Mar-a-Lago, and a normal way to make a decision of this consequence, literally taking out the second most powerful leader of a country, would be to have the National Security Council asking every hard question, every tough question, mm-hmm. every what-if question. That wasn't done at all.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean,
think
about it. Let's think about the practical impact here, which is that even if it wasn't intentional that the president would do this to take attention away from the impeachment situation, I mean, to what effect does that actually happen?
Well, it obviously, when we get back, there's going to be an enormous focus on what's going on with Iran. Mm-hmm. And impeachment is obviously another major issue. But even as we were doing impeachment and it dominated the news, you know, what I'm really happy about is that in those last couple of weeks in the House, we passed prescription drug legislation that would bring down the cost of the prescription drugs by $500 billion over 10 years. We passed the law and got it signed to really crack down on these horrible robocalls that Vermonters are flooded with and they really, really hate.
Mm-hmm,
We passed another bill on prescription drugs to stop the pharmaceutical companies from abusing their patents by paying generic companies to delay coming out with the lower cost but equally effective products. So even as this will now be another dominant issue in the news, impeachment and Iran, I want to focus constantly and trying to do things that are going to help a middle class that's really struggling with high health care prices, with stagnant wages. And we know we have to start focusing on climate change. I mean, look what's happening in Australia.
Yeah. Hey, but just one more question on the impeachment thing. I mean, what's your prediction? When do these articles go to the Senate?
I think it'll be sooner rather than later. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously, there was nothing the Senate was going to be doing when we were on the Christmas recess. But, you know, there is a question here about Senator McConnell. He's made it very clear that he's hand in glove with the White House. So he's making it very, very clear that he has no interest in a fair trial. And when I say a fair trial, calling witnesses, getting evidence, he basically wants a dismissal. He's saying that quite explicitly.
Yeah.
And some of the Republican members of the Senate, like Senator Murkowski, Senator Collins, are raising questions as to the basic fairness. So yeah. I think all of us are entitled to a fair trial. And I think the senators owe it to us that they provide a fair trial.
All right. Well, Congressman Peter Welch, we've covered some hot topics this morning. I really appreciate you joining me and taking a little bit of heat on a couple of those phone calls. You're a trooper for doing that. And we'll have you on again soon, I hope.
Great.
All right.
Dave, thanks for the dollars, too.
Yeah. We're going to go to a bottom of the hour break here for some CBS News. We'll be back shortly, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can't stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back, and my next guest is, I should say, my next guest needs no introduction, but that's already been used. So, Colin Mine is the managing editor of VTDigger.org, and he's getting to be such a regular on the Dave Graham Show, which we really appreciate, by the way, that he almost needs no introduction. And Colin, good morning.
Morning.
Hey, you have some good stories in the on the Digger website today, and let's get right to a couple of them. One is this story that broke yesterday, I guess, really, about the Brattleboro retreat. What's happening down there?
Yeah, so it's an interesting development over the weekend. Agency of Human Services Secretary Mike Smith, who was appointed to the job just a few months ago and seemingly had taken on one momentous task after the next. But apparently the Brattleboro retreat contacted him and told them that they were going to need $2 million to continue operating next year. He is loath to provide that money. He says that financial mismanagement should not be rewarded or supplemented by the state. And among the options, they say, if they're not able to get this $2 million, is closing or sort of temporarily or permanently closing Brattleboro Retreat, which, of course, is central to Vermont's sort of mental health treatment system ever since Hurricane Irene, of course, and a number of patients were moved there. And it's really become rather essential to the way that Vermont treats people and sort of handle the patient load. But Secretary Smith says that he does not believe in too big to fail when it comes to the healthcare system, and that he is currently putting together some sort of strategy to potentially care for patients currently at the Brattleboro retreat if indeed they decide to close down over the state's decision to or not to give them this $2 million. Also, the lawmakers from down in Windham County, where Brattleboro is located, of course, are saying that they're frustrated by Secretary Smith's decision. They think that the Brattleboro retreat, you know, they want to see it supported and believe that. So it seems like there'll be a bit of a debate going into the legislative session, which starts tomorrow, about whether or not to give the retreat this money.
Boy, yeah, and it just feels like, you know, there's a little bit of gun to the head here going on right at the beginning of the legislative session to say we need a huge infusion of state cash. I mean, is that fair, or do you think that this is a really legitimate ask here?
Yeah, well, Ann Donohue, who's a Republican who leads the House Healthcare, or who helps to lead the House Health Committee, said that she believes that the Brattleboro retreat is trying to build a sustainable model on the back of state funding. So, you know, there's an idea perhaps that this sort of way that the Brattleboro retreat is operating at the moment is unsustainable, and perhaps, you know, this will lead to a broader debate about how that's being done and whether the retreat should be at the center of Vermont's sort of mental health care system. You know, as far as putting a gun to the head, I think this is probably, you know, for folks who have been like you, who have been around the legislature longer than me, that you start the session with your big ask and hope to get, you know, something between zero and that. So we also have OneCare, the Accountable Care Organization, going into the session saying that it needs something like $13 million in additional Medicaid funding. So, you know, a lot of big asks going into the session, and then it's on lawmakers, of course, to decide who gets what they need and what exactly they do need.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to sort out. I mean, and there have been issues around the Brattleboro retreat for a long time now. One of maybe the biggest ones is just I mean, I covered some retreat stories during my you know, years at the Associated Press, and certainly since Tropical Storm Irene in 2011, you know, the retreat has been basically a savior to the health state's mental health system. I mean, you know, I remember Patrick Flood, the former mental health commissioner, just saying that he's not sure what the state would have done without that sort of relief valve of having the retreat there and able to take patients from the state system when they maybe would have had nowhere else to go.
As you said, it's also worth noting that we're in the midst of this broader conversation about how to expand capacity for mental health care.
Yeah.
You know, there are these anecdotal stories about people being stuck in emergency rooms for weeks at a time because there's, you know, nowhere the retreat is full, the Berlin facility is full, and it leaves no space for sort of immediate care of mental health needs. So people get stuck in emergency rooms which really aren't equipped to handle them. So, you know, the idea of having the retreat sort of take itself offline really seems like, you know, $2 million is well worth the cost of what that would take. You know, I think that Governor Phil Scott has, you know, often preached in many different sectors that the state has to live within its means and that sort of thing. So, you know, I think there's a bit of messaging going on here that they don't want sort of facilities to, you know, take the state support for granted. The idea of actually, you know, having to move dozens of patients out of one facility to another when, you know, there's nothing really to move them to seems like something of an impossibility.
Yeah.
And it's also worth noting that the retreat says that even if they don't get this money, they do think that they can sort of find a way out of it. So a lot of tough talk sort of on both sides. You'd have to imagine that they're going to work out some way to keep the retreat operating for at least some time until, you know, there's plans underway to build new facilities for UVM to expand some of its facilities to take more mental health patients. So, you know, maybe in the long term, the retreat doesn't need to be sort of in the position it's in. But, you know, as far as something immediate, it seems rather unlikely and that it would be unfortunate if something can't get sorted out.
Yeah. Hey, I wanted to bring a listener in who's been waiting on the line. Xenia from Barrytown. Good morning, Xenia.
Hi. Just a bit of history to go back to the situation in the Middle East.
Oh, sure.
This is like the Gulf of Tonkin, that we get word that, oh, there's been new intelligence, blah, 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 which turns out to be pretty unfounded. And so here's Senator Barbara Jordan from Texas talking to President Lyndon Baines Johnson. And he says that, oh, he's not in Vietnam to save his face, and he's just sent thousands and thousands of more people. But to save his, but not the actual word that.
Yeah.
Okay. So she replies that, being a lady, she couldn't use that word.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what was that part of the president's anatomy doing in Southeast Asia?
Okay. Nice little anecdote there, Xenia. Thanks for adding that to
and
the discussion
so,
here.
The best way to have, American troops not harmed in the Middle East is to bring them back.
That would be one approach for sure. Yeah.
Okay, and the retreat is an abusive pit and always has been. And I had a friend that was there, and she was badly abused, and the stories have come out of there for years. They would be better off making it totally for substance abuse and strengthen and multiply smaller programs around the state,
mm-hmm.
Like one that Washington County has in Barry, a hospital diversion program called Home Intervention,
yep.
And the Alyssum peer-run program in Rochester, and there are good little programs around the state that are not abusive institutions like the retreat, and they're a lot less expensive, too.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure that the Human Services folks will be looking into those options, I suspect they're feeling in a bit of a squeeze right now. So, thanks for the call, Xenia. Two good mentions there, and I appreciate you checking in with us. Colin, mine, VT Digger has a number of other stories. There was one here that's quite disturbing, frankly, about a 6-year-old in Cabot getting suspended from school for 10 days for a drawing. What's going on here?
Yeah, so we heard from the parents of this child a couple weeks ago and have been sort of working on, you know, confirming aspects of their story and sort of understanding what was happening there. But, you know, basically they, a 6-year-old son who is biracial has some behavior issues, it seems, has drawn some pictures that, were rather frightening to teachers, I guess, a picture of apparently himself wielding a large chainsaw with some other stick figures with their heads cut off and sort of blood gushing from their neck, that kind of thing. So, you know, rather, I don't know how to describe them, certainly violent scenes, and I guess teachers asked this child, you know, what it was, and he sort of named the stick figures as some of his classmates and that side kind of thing. So the decision was made to suspend him for 10 days. You know, we talked to a lot of folks, both lawmakers and sort of experts in, school remedies and punishment, that kind of thing. And everyone seems rather alarmed that any behavior by a 6-year-old would lead to a 2-week suspension. There's been a tremendous amount of research that has shown that that kind of punishment at a young age and even at an older age leads to much higher chances of things like, you know, dropping out of school, of illegal behavior in the future and that kind of thing. So really the best practices are supposed to be to find alternate remedies, to work with students, to, in school find ways to sort of deal with these types of things. And then we requested data from the Agency of Education and found that in the past year some 80 first graders have been suspended. That's in-house and out-of-school suspension, so we're not quite sure how many of those are the same type of suspension as this kid. First through third grade, some 300 students. So, schools are really supposed to be trying to move away from these suspension practices, you know, any sort of punishment that removes someone from the classroom and from sort of the social fabric of their classes. Maybe not happening as quickly as some would like. And in this particular case, just really harsh punishments for a very young child. And then some mixed messages from the school as far as why it was happening. The parents, the school started to say that there was some pushing and shoving during some sledding outside and that kind of thing. The parents said they had never heard anything about it, and that as far as they knew, this was merely about the drawing that I described earlier. So, a rather worrying situation and something that maybe points to some practices that continue on that, lawmakers and the Agency of Education say they're trying to get away from.
Well, and it's I have to note your mention of the fact that this student is biracial. The ACLU had a really troubling report out a year or two, and maybe even 3 ago now. I've lost track of time a little bit here, but talking about what they call the school to prison pipeline, and how there are major imbalances in Vermont's justice system in terms of the what percentage of people of color end up in Vermont's prisons versus their overall presence in the population, and so on. And the ACLU was trying to make the point that a lot of this sort of extra strong corrective action that people get begins in schools. Is that become a thread of this story here?
Yeah, for sure. And that's one of the big reasons why people say they want to get away from punishments in which children are removed from the classroom, is because research shows time and again that the people who end up being most harmed or sort of who face those types of punishment most often are students of color and students with disabilities. So, you know, and then you get into the why of that. You know, there's obviously very complicated sort of reasons why that might be, but the sort of fact is advocates say that inevitably that's what happens, and therefore moving away from those punishments is the right direction to go in.
Yeah, I mean, and I hope that during that 10 days was well used in terms of really intervening well and carefully with this child and trying to make sure that whatever was showing up in these drawings was addressed. I mean, if there are some psychological problems going on here, they clearly need to be worked with. And you know, you hope that the young person gets the right mental health care and all that sort of thing, that they don't end up acting out later on in life in ways that really bring trouble and pain and suffering and all that to people around the kid.
Yeah, and I should mention that neither the principal at the elementary school or the superintendent would talk about this particular case, citing sort of confidentiality concerns. The superintendent said that, you know, this type of punishment, basically that they do have the best practices of not, removing kids from school, but that sometimes it's necessary, that it's done in very rare case-by-case circumstances. The parents of this child told us that it wasn't the first time that it happened, that the child is often removed for an entire day and put in a classroom by himself and that sort of thing, which, again, is really not what most schools are trying to do, or at least say they're trying to do these days. Always difficult in these types of situations, both health and education, because of all the privacy rules and laws around it, to really understand how the school came about the decisions it made. A story that concerned a lot of folks that we talked to.
Yeah, and I am not surprised. That's a tough situation there, and certainly I hope they get it resolved in the best way possible. The former Southern Vermont College president, this is one of Vermont's closed schools, assuming the Board of Trustees there. What's that about?
Yeah, so this is David Evans, who, as you said, is the former president of Southern Vermont College. And suing trustees, you know, the school is closing. There's sort of creditors. They're trying to figure out how to pay people back, how to line people up as far as who gets paid back first and that kind of thing. Evans was pushing to have people who are owed wages and that sort of thing paid back first. It sounds like the trustees, he accuses these four trustees of having, he says they loan the college money, and we're trying to sort of prioritize that as far as the who gets paid back first and that sort of thing. So accusing sort of these trustees of using their position to represent their personal interests over the more general interests of staff and faculty and that sort of thing. And it's worth noting this is the second lawsuit to sort of come out of the closing of Southern Vermont College, which is going to be sold to a boarding school, the Oliverian School, for $4.9 million. And there was a previous lawsuit between leaders of the school as well.
So. Yeah, by the way, the Oliverian School, are they planning on moving to Vermont from their current location in New Hampshire, or is this like an expansion for them, or do you know what's the deal there?
Yeah, I think this is an expansion, and this isn't going to be used as a core campus. It's going to be used more of like a sort of outing and sort of extracurricular in an expansion of their current campus. I don't think it's entirely clear what exactly they're going to use it for, but that it's not going to be a separate school or a moving of the school, but rather a sort of a separate facility or a separate campus to be used for other types of classes and that kind of thing.
I see. Okay. Hey, of course, we have this outfit called the Vermont Legislature, which is going to show up in Montpelier tomorrow, an upcoming legislative session. One of the issues which is going to be up, people tell us early on, is a debate over further tinkering with Vermont's marijuana laws. And Xander Landon had a very interesting story looking at concerns that when you legalize marijuana, you don't necessarily do away with the black market. Tell us, Xander Landon, of course, a reporter for VT Digger, is doing an excellent job there covering a lot of the political issues at the State House. So, Colin, what did Xander discover here?
Yeah, so with each passing year that Vermont does not legalize marijuana, we sort of get more data from the states that have. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you know, anecdotally, we had heard a couple stories of, you know, in articles, news reports, that sort of thing, of states finding that their black markets, and this is particularly true in California, that the black market, you know, there's this idea that when marijuana is legalized, that the sort of industry shifts to the, you know, legal stores and retailers and dispensaries and that sort of thing, but that in places like California, they're finding that that's not really the case, that, you know, there's the legal market, but that the black market continues to thrive. And some of the reasons for that, the taxes that are placed on legal marijuana certainly add a significant amount to the cost there. And then there's also this sort of domination by some big players and owners of dispensaries, which sort of allow them to control significantly control the market and set the prices and that kind of thing, so that the black market can actually become a more affordable alternative to marijuana being sold through legal channels. So, you know, this is very much one of the sort of talking points for advocates, and this sort of undermines the idea that, you know, if you legalize marijuana and tax and regulate it, that you can sort of do things like consumer protection, you know, the idea being that you can test and you can control what's sold on the legal market, and that's not necessarily the case, that if people still want to sort of look to the black market for these products, that they're going to be able to find them.
And of course, you got to know, you got to remember, the black market is already quite well established. You know, I mean, the networks are out there; they've been operating in some cases for years, and they don't really want to go anywhere. And so, if they can figure out a niche and figure out that they can underprice what's being sold in a retail outlet, they are probably going to do that. Is that? I mean, that's sort of capitalism, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And then it comes down to, you know, why is the black market continuing to thrive? I mean, the other state is more close to New Hampshire is Massachusetts, which, of course, just legalized marijuana quite recently. They found that 75% of marijuana sales in the state are still technically illegal. So, you know, haven't really put a tremendous dent in the black market.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that strikes me, though, that it could change over time. I mean, it takes, you're developing a whole new, you know, legal industry here that would probably take some time to, you know, kind of come to develop itself, you know, come to fruition and actually figure out how to price its products and maybe for the state government to figure out how to, you know, at what level can we tax? I mean, a lot of this is sort of what the market will bear. And I don't know whether there is a way to really, you know, I don't know what the bottom line here is. You'd have to talk to an economics person or somebody who's an expert in, you know, retail pricing or something, whether you can sort of outcompete and or scare away people who have been operating illegally for years and continue to want to do so. I mean, I could imagine that you could end up with sort of two approaches operating in parallel, one in which the consumer wants to be able to go into some kind of a shop and look at the label and know, you know, am I buying beer or whiskey, you know, to use that analog, and just in terms of strength and so on, you know, wants to know, you know, maybe my favorite is, you know, some brand or another of marijuana that I particularly like that high or something like that, you know, people would have a much better opportunity to sort of know what they're getting in a retail setting than in the traditional street buy. And, you know, and so there's a possibility there. I mean, heaven knows we have a wide variety of approaches to people who want to consume alcohol in Vermont. Everything from the state liquor store to buying a six pack at a supermarket to home brewing. You know, so and obviously going to bars and pubs and stuff. So and all of those things on the alcohol side of the ledger seem to operate in some kind of you know, stasis or whatever. They're not, and so maybe there's a settling out process that would be needed here. Is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely true that it takes time. But I think the question is, you know, we're sort of in the midst of this debate whether it should happen or not. And a lot of the arguments being made for why it should happen, things like it's going to bring a lot of money into state coffers because, you know, you can put a hefty tax on this and bring it in. you know, then maybe that's something you want to think twice about, that the more you tax, the less likely it is that you're actually going to shift consumers over from the black market. So maybe you want to sort of lower your expectations around how much revenue this is going to bring into the state. And then another big thing that's happened in Massachusetts is that very large sort of, you know, hedge fund or private equity type of concerns have become very involved in buying up different operations, despite rules meant to sort of keep it there. But the more the industry is consolidated, the more, you know, sort of price points are set by, you know, big companies as opposed to smaller players where there might be more competition and therefore lower prices. So, you know, just sort of raising, I think you're absolutely right that, you know, this doesn't happen overnight and that, you know, you don't sort of undo an entire black market simply by passing a new law. But at the same time, I think it raises some important points as the legislature is set for, you know, I don't know how many years in a row debating whether or not Vermont should have a legal tax and regulated marijuana market.
Yeah, and remember, the speculation here is always, I'm a skeptic about speculation, especially in this area. I mean, you think about the idea that all during the debate, which preceded making possession of up to an ounce legal in Vermont as of July of 2018, you know, there was a lot of worry about what that would do to traffic safety. Well, who knew, but road, you know, highway fatalities are way down in Vermont in the last year and a half since that law went into effect. Now, whether there's any correlation in there, frankly, I personally have my doubts, but they didn't go up, that's for sure. So
yeah, and I'd also note fatalities are down, but, you know, people being pulled over or cited for suspected intoxicated driving is up. And then again, you know, does that mean because more people are, you know, using marijuana and driving, or is that because police are more attuned to it and watching for it?
Yeah.
Hard to say.
Hard to say. Hey, Colin Mine, I really appreciate you joining me this morning. It's always good chatting with you. Let's do it again real soon.
Pleasure, Dave. Thanks.
All righty. Talk to you soon. Go to top of the hour break here on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. And stay with us, folks. We're going to have an interesting conversation about the Middle East with somebody who spent a lot of time there. That's Peter Galbraith. He'll be joining us in the second hour of the Dave Graham Show, as will a CBS News correspondent to talk to us about the news that's breaking. All righty. We'll be back shortly. Stay with us.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back, continuing into our the second half hour of our program on this Monday morning. It is January the 6th, 2020. And speaking of folks who see 2020, our CBS News correspondents are really good, and they are out there around the world checking into what is going on in a variety of hot spots. And got one of them on the line with us this morning. Jeff McCausland joins us to talk about the situation in the Middle East since Thursday's action in Iraq, although it seems to have been directed at Iran. What's the latest we're hearing on all this, Jeff?
Well, Dave, we've seen, of course, the funeral of Qasem Soleimani, this Iranian, really senior military and political figure, probably the second or third most powerful political military figure in the country of Iran, and literally hundreds of thousands of Iranians turning out in the street for those particular ceremonies as the body was moved from town to town and eventually to Tehran and now onto his home. Subsequently, of course, we've had a vote by the Iraqi parliament over the weekend calling for the beginning of a plan to remove all U.S. forces from Iraq, because as you pointed out, this guy was killed on Iraqi soil, and alongside him was a very senior Iraqi militia leader of a popular mobilization force that's sanctioned by the Iraqi military, supported by the Iranians, but sanctioned by the Iraqi military, and a former member of parliament. And as well, we've had Iran announcing that revenge will be taken upon the United States, obviously unclear what that might be. And then finally, of course, the Iranians have announced that they're going to suspend all their adherence to the so-called Iran nuclear deal, which could allow them to begin reprocessing nuclear material and eventually move in the direction of a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, boy, that's a scary thought. Now, in the terms of the action by the Iraqi parliament to say that the United States troops should be get out of the country, basically, was that the whole? Did they actually have a quorum? My understanding is that there was a question about, you know, to what degree they were in attendance there at that vote.
Well, that's exactly right, Dave. You know, it's a question whether this was a binding vote by the Iraqi parliament. But it's interesting to note that the prime minister, at least acting prime minister of Iraq, he has resigned because of demonstrations that occurred, that were occurring in large scale even prior to the killing of Soleimani, actually called for this particular vote and suggested that he was strongly in favor of the U.S. departing. We know in that parliament there are a large number of parliamentarians who are supported and part of these Shiite militia groups that were supported by Iran, but again sanctioned by the Iraqi military. And prayers were held on the floor of the parliament for Soleimani prior to that particular vote being taken. So it makes it pretty difficult whether or not that is a binding agreement, whether the United States will then move forward remains to be seen. But another development of the weekend is the U.S. military in Iraq has announced a suspension, at least, of its activities against ISIS in Iraq and its training of Iraqi security forces. A lot of that was done by civilian contractors, and based on recent events, civilians have been told to leave Iraq, number one. Number two, U.S. military forces are kind of hunkered down on their bases for fear of, you know, attacks by these militia groups or perhaps green-on-blue attacks even by members of the Iraqi military. So since that was our mission for being there, training the Iraqi military and, if you will, continuing the efforts to finally destroy ISIS, if we can't perform the mission, the question of why we're there then looms large.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm wondering if, to the extent the United States remains there in any fashion, really, and if the Iraqi parliament's vote is deemed legitimate, does that really render the United States in much more stark relief, purely an occupying force?
Well, I guess so. I mean, we have said this is a sovereign country, and in 2003, when we invaded, we said one of our goals was to create political conditions where a sovereign Iraq could elect its own government, and they have done that, albeit it might be imperfect, but it is a sovereign country. Mm-hmm. They invited us back in 2014 because of the threat posed by ISIS. And so once again, if that sovereign country votes that we should leave, that puts you in a tough spot unless you want to hunker down your base and defend it. And furthermore, why are you staying to do what besides defend yourself? The president, of course, in response, has tweeted out that if Iraq should force our troops to leave the country, that he will impose enormous sanctions against Iraq, far in excess of the sanctions on Iran, and demand billions of dollars in payment for the bases that we have created.
Yeah.
Which, again, is unusual since this is a matter of national sovereignty.
I mean, it just strikes me as weird. I don't know what other type of human relationship you would go to somebody's country at their invitation, and then when they ask you to leave, you're backing out the door and saying, I'm going to impose really tough sanctions on you. And I don't know, that just doesn't, the whole thing is bizarre beyond belief. I guess that's,
Well, Dave, I think you're exactly right. And don't forget, President Trump campaigned in 2016 on that it was his goal to remove all U.S. forces from Iraq.
Yeah,
he is demanding that they stay, which makes it even doubly curious.
and I'll tell you, I have a number of callers here on the show who call in and really seem to support the president no matter what he does, and they were very friendly to the president's initial discussions about trying to extricate the United States from the Middle East, and they were fully supportive of that. And just today they called up and were talking about how it's a really great thing that he's done here, and which seems to get the United States much more deeply into the Middle East. So I don't know. It seems like, the president famously said he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and his supporters would still be with him. Well, I guess he could pull off this assassination of this general from Iran, and his supporters are still with him for sure. So there you go.
I think, and to put this in a context, I think what's important to think about is the killing of Soleimani. And let's be honest, no tears for this guy. This was a bloodthirsty guy who had the blood of hundreds of Americans on his hands for the exporting of improvised explosive devices from Iran that were put in the hands of Shia militia groups back in 2006 and 7 that killed lots of Americans. The blood of literally thousands of people in Syria and Yemen and elsewhere, the support he provided as head of the Quds Force for all the different fighting that was going on there. But the killing of him is a means to an end, not an end state. It's tactical success, but the question is it a strategic success?
Yeah.
One has to ask, what's the end state? Now, if the end state, you only have two possibilities. One is you're going to force the Iranians to negotiate some kind of a political settlement. Or number two, you plan on taking out the regime and toppling the regime. Well, if you take out the second or third most powerful political figure, military figure in the country, they probably think you're trying to take it down the government. And as a result, what we've seen now, of course, rather than leaving, is we dispatched 3,000 paratroopers to Kuwait. We're sending a Ranger regiment over there. We're dispatching 2,500 more Marines to the Eastern Mediterranean, so they're going to be available. We've sent 14,000 additional troops to the region since May prior to these particular attacks. So it doesn't seem like we're leaving anytime soon, but it looks like we're getting deeper and deeper into a very troubled world there in the Middle East.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things maybe even almost sad about this is just that President Trump might have brought some people who have been skeptical about his presidency around. People, you know, the old time supporters of peace, you know, the folks who have been skeptical of U.S. foreign military involvements forever. Here came this president who was doing a whole number of things that probably bugged some of these people, and I'm thinking mainly of liberals and progressives here now, and even older ones who may have, you know, grown up going to Vietnam War protests and stuff, and you know, etc. And if he could have told them at this stage of his political career, you know, you should vote for me as I run for re-election because I've done this thing of actually, you know, reducing the U.S. military footprint overseas. I think he would have scored some points with people. And apparently that's out the window now.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you also have to think back to the following question. Now, this was done ostensibly because it prevented an imminent attack. That was the argument the administration has presented. The operative word there for me is imminent. Well, Qasem Soleimani was planning all kinds of events throughout the Middle East. You know,
yeah.
Planning an attack against American interests, another day at the office for this guy.
Right.
But he's hardly the guy who's going to put in the IED, pull the trigger, or drop the bomb. So I don't see how taking him out stops an imminent attack. Second of all, of course, the president said, well, we had intel about this. But so far, at least, the administration has presented absolutely nothing in terms of that intel, not only to the American public, but to the senior members of Congress who want to say, what was this imminent intelligence? And don't forget, the United States got involved in this whole region back in 2003 because of really ironclad intelligence that the Iraqis were making an imminent nuclear weapon.
I was just going to say, weapons of mass destruction. Yeah,
$1 trillion.
Yeah,
that's why we killed 4,500 young Americans.
Yeah,
so forgive my skepticism.
Yeah.
At a minimum, it seems like you need to share it. And last but not least, of course, this is a president who is has been impeached and might want to change the subject. Number one, and this is a president who routinely has criticized the intelligence community as being wrong, incorrect, or biased about its intelligence about Russia, about its intelligence about North Korea. But suddenly, this particular intelligence about a quote-unquote imminent attack was ironclad.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, I think that that paints a somewhat disturbing picture, and I guess that's what needs to be painted today. So, Jeff McCausland, I thank you very much for joining me this morning to help us understand these events, and we'll be talking soon.
Take care.
Okay, you too. We have a caller on the line. Rama joins us this morning. Good morning, Rama.
Yeah, hey, good morning. You know, the United States has spent actually somewhere after World War One. World War Two was the first war over oil, actually, a good portion of it. But since the breakup of the Turkish Empire, right after World War One, and it's where you ended up with a lot of these separate countries, and a lot of the destabilization began there. Political destabilization began in that part of the world because of outside influences. At first, it was primarily Europeans, and then it became United Statesian, especially post World War Two. And we had reached a point under President Obama where people were actually looking and saying, you know, how can we deal with this as a stable area so that we don't have to go, keep going on with all these wars and we can start talking with people instead of throwing bombs at each other. But the problem is that there's this huge military-industrial complex that wants wars. And you know, they were, for some reason, Trump was holding out Iran separate from everybody else for who he would talk to. He would not, and I think a lot of it has to do with Israel, but I also think it has to do with that he needed to have an outlet so that the people that want to build bombs and drop them have a place to do it. And they don't care if it's real reasons. And when I say they, I guess I'm talking about the military-industrial complex, the people that make the money off of it, exporting our wars. They don't care if it's a real thing that we go to war for. I mean, it's imagined weapons of mass destruction and for Dummy Bush, and now Trump with just, you know, hey, I know, I'll just go kill somebody on an official governmental trip from one country to another because he's doing something to us. You know, it doesn't matter if they make this up or not. This is about money. War is about money. War is about economics. And the people that are going to make the money off of it, frankly, don't care about the pain and the misery they cause, and they have a very useful idiot in the form of Trump, and so this is where this is going. And there are people that want to go and drop the bombs, and it's going to take a lot more courage and a lot more vision from those of us that say, no, you don't get to drop the bombs, you get to stop being stupid.
All right, Rama, thank you for the call, appreciate it. Let's go to Mike in Northfield. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. There are consequences to going to war, especially invading other countries like we did Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria. I mean, you can go on and on. The consequences, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and Agent Orange has done me in, and the burn pits are doing our Afghanistan and Iraqi veterans, it's harming them. And those are the consequences, and the cost of medical care through the VA or however we get it is astronomical. And it'd be a lot cheaper if we'd stop spending money on wars and put it into health care for everyone and put it into education for everyone. We'd be a lot better off that way.
And
I'll hang up and listen.
Well, Mike, I want you to hang on just for one minute, because I have a question for you. I'm trying to balance the interests of the United States in going to war. In other words, there's got to be some upside for somebody. Now, Rama was just on saying it's a big upside for military contractors and weapons manufacturers who get to sell their stuff and make money. And what people don't remember is the downside that you talk about. I mean, you say that Agent Orange has done you in. And obviously, you know, a lot of people point to Vietnam as the model of the kind of war that was mainly about, you know, pumping up the military-industrial complex and didn't really accomplish much, et cetera. But the, you know, when you think about the downside for individuals like you, and as you mentioned, the burn pits and how sick people have gotten as a result of you know, chemical exposures there, it's really just I think people need to focus more on the costs, and it's difficult to convince the majority of people that, because not everybody knows somebody who has lived with the effects of Agent Orange, you know, through these subsequent 40.
The consequences are awful.
Yeah, tell me about that. I mean, what have been the health effects in your life of that exposure?
About 11 or 12 years ago, I came down with diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
I now have neuropathy, and I've always had tinnitus from the artillery and stuff.
Yeah,
near me. I have hearing loss. I've got several different things, all caused from basically from Agent Orange.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, obviously, you know, I have this impulse to want to thank you for your service. I doubt that would even really resonate with you very much, because certainly your service has cost you just so much more than most Americans are aware of or really know about, or frankly, I think in too many cases care about. And that's one of the things that makes this too easy, doesn't it? I mean, it kind of, the fact that most of the public is unaware of what you and your thousands of fellow veterans suffer after coming back from these wars, that does make it easier, doesn't it?
Yeah. When I go down to the VA and I talk to other guys affected by Agent Orange, and now these new guys, the younger generation affected from burn pits, and I see guys walking around with an artificial limb, that stuff all costs money. And, you know, we could save so much if we didn't go to war for no good reason. World War II, in my opinion, was the last war that we really should have been into.
I'm not even just talking about the money, Mike. I'm talking about the human suffering.
The lives.
Yeah,
I'm
talking about whatever your health effects have cost you in terms of just the physical pain, whatever they've cost you in terms of damage to your career, etc. Unfortunately, we got to go to a bottom 8 hour news break here. But Mike, I really appreciate the call. Thank you so much. Stay in touch with us, will you? All right, we'll go CBS News upcoming. A couple words from our sponsors. We'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot, and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes, or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back. And I'll tell you, I love the bumps in the road on live radio. People tell me I'm crazy, but I just say it's a little bit like going out four-wheeling on the old logging roads in the woods. It's probably less environmentally damaging or whatever. And so we just bump along here and get to where we need to be, which is talking with Peter Galbraith. I have been introducing you for a little bit here, Peter. Thanks for joining me.
Nothing like a filibuster.
You're a gentleman and a scholar for joining us this morning. You're in Switzerland, right?
I am.
What are you doing in Switzerland?
Skiing.
Skiing, good for you. You know what? I actually took that guess. I said he could just be skiing. Maybe he's in the middle of some international diplomatic intrigue over there, but he could just be skiing. So I'm glad to hear you're enjoying a little vacation time over there. That's great. So tell me, I'm sure you've also been following the news during your après-ski moments over there, and this attack by the United States on the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. It's causing a lot of international upset, and I know you've spent significant time in the Middle East. Refresh us on your sort of, give us a brief recap of the resume in connection with the Middle East.
Well, I've followed this part of the world, and specifically Iraq, Iran, Syria, since 1979. In fact, since the Iran hostage crisis. At that time, I was working for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where I was for 14 years. Then I had a little diversion as ambassador to Croatia. But after that, as a professor in the National Defense University, and then as somebody who was helping the Iraqi Kurds negotiate de facto independence in the Iraqi constitution, as somebody who wrote extensively about Iraq, somebody who went to Iran in 2015, leading the first trip from Harvard University to the country, as somebody who's made 15 trips to Syria since the war began. It's an area I know fairly well.
That's what we thought.
And some of the actors and many of the actors involved in all of this.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the assertion by the president and his people that Qasem Soleimani was actively planning some attack on the United States or its people or its interests that was unusual enough to warrant this action, his essential assassination?
Well, first, I don't know the evidence that Trump may have had to have made the decision.
Mm-hmm.
If, in fact, he had any evidence at all. Some of the press reporting suggests that the evidence was pretty thin. The United States and Iran have been in hostile relations for a very long time, although at times they've also cooperated. They cooperated in Afghanistan against the Taliban. They cooperated most recently in the fight against the Islamic State, and Qasem Soleimani was a major part of it. Now, Soleimani, in after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which brought to power Iran's allies, U.S. military then went after some of these Iranian allies, including the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, and Soleimani came to their support, and yes, there was conflict between Iranian forces or forces that were trained by the Iranians and U.S. forces. All of that, it's a very big step from there to the actual assassination of one of the most important figures in Iran. I mean, imagine it would be the equivalent of the Iranians assassinating the Secretary of Defense or the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Yeah, I mean,
it was a very provocative action. And, you know, we have an impulsive president who is extremely dishonest, so we can't really rely on his word. Now, it might be true, but when you keep lying, people just can't rely on him.
Well, the president himself has been very, very skeptical in many instances of the information that has been produced in recent years by the United States intelligence apparatus. And obviously, I would think that if he has any evidence that Soleimani was involved in planning some imminent attack on the United States or its interests, that would have come from some of the same intelligence sources the president has spent most of his term so far poo-pooing.
Right. Well, of course, he's deeply skeptical of the intelligence that suggested that the Russians played a significant role in his election,
mm-hmm.
Although that's the unanimous conclusion of the intelligence agencies. He's skeptical of intelligence's conclusions he doesn't like. He's also one who's never been reluctant to blurt out national secrets, so it does make it a question as to why he isn't sharing the supposed intelligence in this case. Whether it exists or not,
mm-hmm.
It's a separate question from whether it's a wise thing to do to assassinate one of the most important people in Iran. It obviously is inviting retaliation. This could easily escalate into a full-scale war. And then Trump has gone ahead and made some absolutely extraordinary threats. He has threatened to destroy Iranian cultural sites.
Yeah.
These are protected by the 1954 Hague Convention, which makes it a war crime to destroy cultural sites. This is a convention that the United States has ratified. It goes against a Security Council resolution that the Trump administration voted for on March 24th, 2017, which again condemned the destruction of cultural monuments and called for the prosecution of people who did it. He has also said, after the expenditure of several trillion dollars and the sacrifice of more than 5,000 lives of American service men and women, that if the Iraqis ask us to leave, which of course is their right as a sovereign country, that he will impose more severe sanctions on Iraq than those that apply to Iran. For what? For having democratically asserted their rights as a sovereign nation, a democratic system, incidentally, that the U.S. has paid an enormous amount, 5,000 lives, $2 trillion to bring about.
You know, that really strikes me as something to think about here now. If the Iraqi parliament, and by the way, I guess there are some questions about the vote in the Iraqi parliament in terms of, I guess they had a quorum, but they did not have the entire body there by any means, from what we hear now. But
well, that's correct. The Kurdish members of parliament boycotted because they actually want the United States forces to remain. You know, they, in spite of Trump's betrayal of the Kurds that we discussed last time, they would like the Iraqi Kurds would like the U.S. troops to remain. They while they can't really trust Trump as reliable, they see that the U.S. is their only real partner to enable them to survive.
Better than nothing, right?
It's quite possible that this will lead to American troops redeploying to Kurdistan and then possibly the breakup of Iraq. Also, the Sunni members of parliament largely didn't show up. So this was a decision taken by the Shiite members, who are about 60% of the population and about 60% of the members of parliament.
Okay. So it, assuming that, we have a legitimate vote in the Iraqi parliament saying, hey, United States, you know, we've been entertaining you as guests for a long time now, and we would like you to leave. The party's over. And the United States chooses not to leave. Are we, in effect, at that point, an occupying force?
Well, we certainly would be acting contrary to international law. I think the one complication here is would be if a part of the country, notably the autonomous Kurdish region, were to ask the U.S. to stay and the U.S. were to go there, and that probably is an action that would then lead to the implementation of the decision of the Kurdish people in a referendum on September 25th, 2017, to vote for independence.
Yeah, that would clearly partition Kurdistan. It would be that would now be the, I guess, effectively, if not, you know, de jure, if I mean de facto, if not de jure, a separate state that would be then hosting a large U.S. military presence. Is that
right? It is already de facto a separate state, and it does host a significant U.S. military presence. If it were to declare independence, and of course, if the U.S. were to recognize it, then as a legal matter, the U.S. forces could continue to stay there, since it would be a decision by a sovereign, independent Kurdistan.
Got it.
But
okay.
All this underscores the really very unpredictable ways in which this story may develop now.
Yeah, I mean that's what is one of the striking aspects here is that there's, you know. People talk about insufficient planning for, say, how to end a war after you start one. That's why that may be why we are in Iraq and Afghanistan going on two decades here. But leaving that aside, even it seems as though this particular situation with the Soleimani killing got less planning than certainly most U.S. military actions. Is that fair?
That seems to be fair. That nobody has anticipated what the consequences are. It seems that what happened here was that the Pentagon behaved the way bureaucrats do, as Henry Kissinger once described. The way you get the choice you want is you present the president with three options: unconditional surrender is option A, option B is the one you want, and option C is a total nuclear war. So obviously the president's going to choose the option you want.
Yeah.
In this case, the killing of Soleimani was the option C, and Trump went ahead and chose that. And then it doesn't appear that there were people in the national security apparatus who have been largely purged by Trump who had the courage to stand up to him and to explain, to insist on explaining what the consequences would be. And there's extraordinary ignorance here. Again, I come back to the threat to destroy cultural monuments, which incidentally are not just Iranian, but these are the monuments of human civilization. And many of them are long pre-Islamic. I mean, the Persepolis is the place of Alexander the Great. And so you make a threat to destroy them. Nobody seems to have briefed the president to say this is a war crime. And, of course, now it's been pointed out, and instead of backing down, he doubled down on saying, yeah, that's what he's going to do. The Secretary of State who, you know, really is not doing his job. I mean, he needs to be speaking strongly about this. Instead, he's ducking the question. Incidentally, what people need to understand is that Trump is putting American servicemen and women in great danger, because if Trump orders the destruction of monuments, which is a war crime, that is an illegal order. And those who carry out an illegal order are themselves responsible for the crime. And so you're going to put American servicemen and women in the position of having to choose between an order from their commander-in-chief and obeying the law.
Yeah, that is a obviously sort of the classic difficult position into which to put anybody in a military situation, you know. And what is your expectation there? Do you think that there would be some kind of a rebellion at that point in the among the troops?
Well, this, of course, would presumably be in order to the Air Force to carry out bombing raids on these monuments, cultural monuments.
Right, right.
Whether there would be I hope there would be resistance or refusal from the top leaders of the military and of the Air Force, and from the pilots.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to imagine. You know, suppose you had a presidential order to gun down 100 children. Would a soldier actually carry that out? I don't think so. I mean, I think the training that we have indicates, well, the president's the commander-in-chief, but he does not have the power to make an illegal order. And this is clearly something that's illegal.
Yeah, boy, to hear the president's rhetoric about this is that, well, Soleimani killed some of our people, and therefore, it sounded like these are just, you know, religious icons or whatever is housed in the various cultural locations that he's talking about here, as in they're less important, but that really does raise some very, very tricky issues I just wonder. I mean, again, nobody knows how this is going to play out. But let me ask you about one possible scenario. I'm not saying it's a strong possibility, but it's frankly one that I think a lot of us would prefer, which is that Iran looks at the situation now and says, you know, they've poked a stick in our eye. We are going to stand down because we don't want to mess with this immense military power that the United States possesses, and that they don't really retaliate. Any chance of that?
There's a chance of it. I mean, that the smart strategy for the Iranians would be to appear to be the reasonable party against the unreasonable Donald Trump, not to take action, to reach out to the Europeans insist that they that they get their companies not to follow the American sanctions, and to in every way operate on the hope and the expectation that Donald Trump won't be president of the United States 54 weeks from now.
Yeah.
And sort of to last it out. They in fact have lasted under these extreme sanctions for a couple of years, so another year wouldn't be that severe. That said, you know, Iran has politics just like the United States. And so you have these leaders, they have vowed revenge. Trump has united the people of Iran against the United States. Incidentally, when I was there in 2015, it was one of the most pro-American places in the world. And even though there are many Iranians who despise the government and the regime, you know, they're now rallying around. So if you're a leader, and especially if you're a hardliner and you've pledged action, can you then do nothing? That becomes politically very difficult, even if strategically and logically it would be better to do nothing. So I think it's possible that scenario will play out. I don't think it's likely.
Yeah,
I hope it does, of course.
Yeah, I I'm just sort of trying to game out all of the different possibilities here, and I my sense of it is just from what I read and hear on in various television and radio reports is that it is unlikely for Iran to do nothing. What's in their arsenal? I mean, what should the United States expect?
Well, there are many things that they could do. Obviously, assassination is a game more than one side can play.
Mm-hmm.
They've been clear that they will not target civilians. They have said that they will target American military targets, mm-hmm. which, of course, in wartime are legitimate targets.
Yep.
We have a lot of facilities around the world and in the United States. But probably the biggest thing they can do is to do what is exactly happening right now, which is to force the United States out of Iraq, to create a situation in which after more than 5,000 dead servicemen and women, another 20,000 severely wounded, $2 trillion, the United States is humiliated and forced out of Iraq. That's certainly much more substantive.
Yeah.
And from an Iranian point of view, a much more significant achievement than, any individual act. But again, I there are lots of things a country can do.
The idea of the United States being forced out of Iraq would certainly solve, the Iranian leadership's problem of pressure and so on. But, hey, Peter Galbraith, unfortunately, we are about out of time here on this segment of the Dave Graham Show. I really appreciate you joining me this morning from Switzerland. I want you to get back to your time off and enjoy that. Thank you so much.
Okay, Dave. Well, great talking to you.
Take care. We're going to go to the top of the hour and the end of the Dave Graham Show here for this Monday morning. Thanks so much for joining us, folks. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayer, Common Sense Radio, and join us again tomorrow for another edition of the Dave Graham Show. Have a great day, everybody.